Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. Hey. So, Mom, do you want to introduce our guest today?
Oh, yes, certainly. Dolores Johnson, and she is a fantastic writer. The book is Say I'm Dead, a family memoir of race, secrets, and love. Her writing focus is on the evolution of attitudes on interracial relationships through American history, with an eye to the accelerating browning of America's future. She has written for Buffalo News, Lunch Ticket, the Writer of Color Anthology, Boundaries and Borders, and I'm not sure if I would pronounce that correctly. And she has consulted on diversity for universities, major corporations, and nonprofits, and has served as a panelist for the Harvard Faculty Seminar on Interracialism. And it's a most interesting book because it's very personal, and that's what makes it so good. So welcome to Writers' Voices.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So, Dolores, why don't you just give us a synopsis of your kind of family story and what Say I'm Dead is about?
Say I'm Dead is a multi-generational story of my family who endured fear, secrets, and separation, and finally transformation, because they were not bound by the forbidding race-mixing norms and laws in America. There were so many norms where people did not agree with race-mixing, so many laws that forbid interracial marriage, that there have been family struggles for generations that go back, I found out, to a great-grandmother who was raped on a plantation. And so the grandmother who helped raise me was mixed race, but nobody ever told me because they didn't talk about those things. But the heart of the book is about my white mother and black father who married secretly in 1943. They met in Indiana where there was an anti-race mixing law. So it was illegal to get married, punishable by 7 years in prison for both the man and the woman.
Oh my God.
Yeah, there had been a lynching of two men outside of Indianapolis at that time, partly the mob that strung them up was enraged because a white woman said that they had raped her, and after they were dead, she recanted and said no, they hadn't. And there was the Ku Klux Klan history of Indiana, where at one time their governor there, a man named Stevenson, was the grand wizard of the National Ku Klux Klan. And so the city councilors and many citizens kept these attitudes forbidding race mixing. And here was my black father and white mother who wanted to get married. What they did when they realized all of these threats against their lives was they planned to run away and get married in New York State where it was legal. And to do so, my mom staged her own disappearance. My father told her if anybody knew what they had done, the law would come after them and he could still possibly be killed or sent to prison. Yeah. And so my mom's parents put her on a train in Indianapolis, and she told them she was going to visit a girlfriend, which was not the plan. And she disappeared into thin air. So when she didn't come home from her supposed vacation, the police got involved, and she had sent them a postcard from New York City saying that she was en route and having a great time. And so the FBI then got involved because she had traveled across four or five states, and it was interstate commerce, missing person. They never found her. They never found her. And the officials closed the file. They stopped searching for her, and they told my grandfather, her father, she had either been murdered or sold into white slavery.
Wow.
And so that was my parents' secret that I never knew and my brothers never knew until we were in our 30s.
Were you never curious about her family? Or what did she say when you said, well, don't I have grandparents on your side? Or did you never ask?
I never asked.
Wow.
The thing was that they felt that the world was so hostile towards mixed race families. They didn't want to stir that pot with their children. They thought it would embed a lot of fear in us and a lot of self-esteem issues. And so they wanted us to live as a normal family, even though when we went out in public, people often mistreated us. There were people who would push their kids, physically push them so they wouldn't touch us. People who spit at us. All kinds of nasty things were said to us in public. People wouldn't wait on my mother when she went to the store with her three little mixed children. All of these things. They didn't want to emphasize that at home. And because she and my dad had vowed never to contact her family again because they didn't want the law to get them, we didn't talk about it.
Weren't they also trying to protect her family in a way?
Yeah, that's true, Monica, because, the hostile environment towards race mixing in the 40s was one where my mom thought there would be a scandal if people knew what she did. And that her dad, who was an electrician that worked on word of mouth, would lose his customers. That her younger sister would never find a suitable mate. They were Catholics and they lived in an all-white Catholic neighborhood. That was their community where they socialized. And she didn't want them to suffer for her decision. She made her own decision and decided to live with it, whatever consequences there were. But she didn't want her family back home to struggle from her decision. And so she kept that secret from everybody, except my mom had a circle of friends that she met who were all in mixed race marriages. And that became her maid family.
Now, were they all, where the wives were white and the husbands black, or were some of it the other way around?
It was some the other way around, but her closest friends were white women, almost all of whom were married to black jazz musicians. Yeah, and so there was a nightclub in Buffalo where we grew up that this band played at. And so there were a lot of people in this circle. They called themselves the Click Club. And some of them were the costume makers. Some of them were the dancers in the floor show. Some of them were the barbers and beauticians that made up the people in the show. And so we grew up in this Click Club family where when people out in the street would, get up and move on the bus because they didn't want to sit by us, we could go to birthday parties and holiday events and just come over, to drink coffee and the kids play together as normal people do within that cloistered Click Club.
Well, that was really nice. It was that she found that.
She went to the Catholic school to enroll my older brother in first grade, and she saw a white woman with a brown daughter. And that's how she got connected to that group.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow. The discrimination that your mother faced was not just from the whites in Buffalo either. She also ran into issues from black people too.
She did, Monica. My father used to call it equal opportunity racism. Because let me put it this way. In 1958, I was 10 years old. That was the first time that there was a national survey conducted by the Gallup poll about interracialism. And the result was that 96% of Americans were against it. They thought it was bad.
Whoa.
So 96% includes all races, all religions, all everybody. And, you know, one of the instances that my mom faced was we were, you know, very modest income family. And there was a notice out in the community, in the Black community, that there was a big national convention coming to town, but the Black people couldn't stay at the hotels. So if families were willing to host these people for room and board so they could go to their convention, they would be paid a certain amount. And my mom thought, oh, this will take care of the Catholic school fees for my older brother. So she signed up. And the day that the people arrived, my mom had gone to every length, you know, to scrub in the corners with a toothbrush. And she sent my brothers down the street to stay at my grandmother's while she gave up her own, the parents gave up their own bedroom and moved into the boys' room. And she had this hot dinner on the stove when they arrived. And when they came into the house, my father called her from the kitchen. And when she came out, the Black couple looked at her and they said, well, who is this? And he said, well, this is my wife, Ella, and she's prepared everything for you. And the woman started to shake her head. She said, somebody should have told us about this. We're not going to spend our vacation here looking at this Black man and this white woman. And they packed up their suitcase and left.
Oh, gosh.
And so, you know, it was everybody that we, where we went, that had an issue with us. And I have to say, I want to go on and talk about a little bit when I grew up, some of the things that happened to me, because there was sort of a double whammy of racism.
Yeah.
Racism because I was considered Black, as most people still today who are mixed are identified by their minority parent. That's the perception of the public, not necessarily what the mixed race person identifies as. But then there was also, you know, being Black and being mixed. There were people who had issues with both. And I'll just tell you one story. When I was in high school, that nobody in my family had ever gone to college, but I was in the honors track and taking advanced placement classes. And I heard from, and I was also bused out into a rich neighborhood. And I heard all of these students in the advanced placement classes talking about going to college. And I thought, well, if they're going, I should go. So I went down to see the guidance counselor, and I was so ignorant of what college was or what it was about or for or where to go. I just said to her, I want to know about going to college. I was just, you know, blind to the whole process. And she raised her eyebrow. She looked at me and she said, Dolores, colored girls don't go to college. Now, I had a report card with straight A's from kindergarten through 12. She had never looked at it. And this is what people talk about when they say implicit bias, that some people just have these attitudes that Black people don't go to college. And she was the guidance counselor. That was her advice to me. So she said, well, if you should do anything, you should take up sewing. And, you know, I was so confused when I left there. I had dressed up special and, you know, was really looking forward to finding out about this new world. And here I was standing outside thinking, I know she didn't look at my record because I have all of these straight A's and one D in sewing. But, you know, I went ahead and found my way to college anyway, despite that lady. But we think about this, you know, even going on till today where you have Black students getting bad advice because of implicit bias.
Well, you found your way to college, but how many other students in that situation didn't? Or maybe someone who didn't have straight A's but had a good enough record.
Well, you're right, Monica. I think that it still goes on today that kids who have promise and ability are not given the support, the encouragement, the advice to get to college.
And, you know, it impacts later generations, even if all of a sudden everything were completely equal now. The fact that women of your generation were discouraged from going to college, then they didn't earn as much money, and then their kids were disadvantaged, and their kids were, you know, it just...
Dominoes. Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Because, you know, studies show that people who go to college over the course of their working life earn $1 million more than people with just a high school education. So your point is right on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You not only went to college, you went to one of the premier historical black colleges, and then you went on and got a master's degree at Harvard in the early 70s. Now, Harvard was only became co-ed when? Not that long before that.
That's right.
So I am guessing that you were one of the very, very few women in your class there, and one of the very few people of color. Were you the only African-American woman?
I wasn't, but I was one of the very first. You're right.
Yeah.
So I went to Howard University for undergrad, and maybe people have heard a lot about Howard recently because of Kamala Harris going there. And we have many stellar graduates from Howard. And it prepared me very well and gave me a lot of confidence where the systems in America, you know, the, for instance, educational system that had not encouraged me, Howard told us, you know, that we could do anything. And so I applied to Harvard and was admitted. And as you say, was one of the first, I would say, handful of African-American women that was admitted to the business school. Because, you know, business is the man's domain. And so being black and a woman was two significant factors in my admission. And by the way, I was the youngest person in my class. There were all these military officers and lots of kids who were the sons and daughters of senators. And sometimes when we would come in to class and we were studying a certain corporation, they would dismiss people in the class because their dad was the chairman of the board. It was that kind of thing.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was really a whole new world for me, a whole new world.
You really got to see the elite side of things.
You're right. And I hadn't had that view before in my life. It was so eye-opening to see how major decisions are made, major policies in America that affect business, how much money is at stake. And, you know, there were some very interesting things that I took away that were not taught. One was ethics. And the other was that never was there mention of any minority in the 2 years that I studied there. We studied 600 different companies. There was never a case about minorities where the officials of the company or the union negotiations or the financing deals with Wall Street, or none of that had any minority person in it. And so it was really, again, a systemic issue of not being seen, not being understood, not being valued. And yet I rose in my career to become a vice president of international marketing in Fortune 500 companies. So it was an uphill climb.
Okay, tell us that story about how you found out that you were underpaid for what you had done and what you did about that. I thought that was pretty amazing how you handled that.
Well, you know, knowing what people that were in my class were making elsewhere, and how the Harvard Business School always emphasized that we were going to make, you know, good money, I was alert to this idea of what I was being paid. And many women do not really look for the better pay or negotiate or ask about it. But I had my father, who had for years come home angry from work. He was a welder, and he was the only black, only minority person at this welding company. And he was never given his full title and never given his right pay. And he was so angry about that, how hard he worked. And when I found out that, of course, I was the only black female there, I found out that all the white men were making as much as 20% more than me. And I had the highest rating for work performance. I thought, I'm not going to be my father. They are not going to do the same thing to me. And so I had a friend in the payroll department who called me and gave me all this information. She said, "Now I'm not telling you this. And if you say I did, I'm going to say I didn't tell you." So don't get into it. But what are you going to do about it? So when my boss came in and told me I'd done a great job and that, and he handed me a paper with a figure on it, and he said, "And this is your raise." And he and I had a pretty good working relationship. I said to him, "You know, I don't think this is commensurate with either my rating and my work performance or what the men in this department are making. And I want to be paid equally." And, of course, he was flabbergasted.
I'll bet.
You know, nobody, he said to me, "But you know, Dolores, you are not the head of the family. These men have mortgages to pay." And I said to him, "You know what? That's not the criteria for a raise as I understand it. And I want you to give me my correct pay." And then my husband and I had rehearsed this in the bedroom over and over. What were we going to say? And I said to him, "You know, I'm going to get in trouble for pushing back. And what if I lose my job, you know, because they get mad?" And he said, "Well, then let's just take that chance because it isn't fair." So I said to my boss, "I want you to go back and fix this." And he said, "Oh, the money's all been distributed. There's no more money. I can't do that." I said, "If you don't, I'm going to go over your head. And I'm going to bring this to the attention of higher management." And actually, I got my money. And I always tell young women, you know, negotiate your salary, because there's having been over large organizations in corporate America, I know there's always money somewhere that could be given, but they don't give it willingly if you don't ask for it.
Yeah.
It's important.
That was really brave. It really was.
It's important when you are starting out a job, you know, starting out your career, to negotiate from the beginning, because you're probably always going to, whatever base you start from, you know, that's going to compound.
Exactly. Exactly. Because the next raise you get is going to be a percentage based off
right.
that first salary and
right.
on and on and on. So
yeah.
You're exactly right.
Yeah. So you, yes, that was brave. And there's a number of other incidences in this book where you, that demonstrate your bravery, although you're very humble in the way that you write about them. But your mother was also very brave, and so I think you must have gotten that from her. The idea in 1943, and how old was she then?
33.
Yeah, for a 33-year-old woman in 1943 to leave everything behind and go marry a black man is, I mean, just, it's almost unthinkable.
And that was the word that was used when all of the secret came out, unthinkable. Because, you know, I believe that I did get that from my mother, because that's an example of making a life that you choose and not doing what everybody else says you should do. And that was kind of what happened there with me going to Harvard, with me, you know, requesting my raise, and later when and me going to college when nobody, you know, my father said to me, why are you filling out those applications? Because we don't have any money. You're not going to go. And still I persisted. It's a word we've heard before. And later on in my career, a chance meeting with one of my company's officers from Europe happened, where out of the clear blue, when I was explaining how certain practices were done in the United States, this man says to me, are you prepared to move to France and work for me?
Yeah, that was amazing, wasn't it?
I mean, just out of the clear blue. And I said to him, to do what? I'd only met him like 10 minutes before. And he said, to do these things that you're explaining. We don't have that, and we need somebody. We need somebody with your skill. We need you to come. And it was such a shocking idea. You know, by then, my husband had died, and I was a single mom of an eight-year-old. And I thought, what? Pick up and go to a place where I don't even speak the language. But eventually, I did do that. And these were all decisions that I made because of the model of my mother, who decided for herself how she was going to make her life.
Did you end up learning French?
I did. As a matter of fact, before I left Europe, I was sitting in engineering meetings were conducted in French, where they were talking about new product designs and shipments overseas and so forth. Now, I could understand more than I could speak, but I think my speaking was pretty good because there were some other American expats that came over there, and they kept saying, we have to learn to speak like Dolores. But, you know, the thing, here's the funny thing. So here I took my daughter, and she's a little kid, and she's going to French schools. And so she and I were invited to a wedding in Brittany, so we went. And as we're checking into the hotel, I'm speaking in French to register. And she's chattering along, you know, with the hotel reservation clerk. And he can't quite follow what I'm saying to him. And so he turns to her and speaks to her in French, and the registration gets done. And you know what the lesson of that was? When we have immigrants in this country, I really can empathize with them, because there I was, a Harvard-educated business executive, and I had to have my kid help me.
Uh-huh. Well, we have this, I think, this reaction sometimes if people don't speak English that they must not be very smart or something. And, I mean, they're a lot of times people who – they may not speak English, but they speak five other languages.
That's right. And they might have been an attorney in their country, or a doctor who hasn't got his license here. Yeah. So, you know, I think that we have to really respect everybody and try to see them for who they really are. And this country's built on immigration. So I hope we can see past the fact that they're an immigrant.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Dolores Johnson, author of Say I'm Dead. Dolores, why don't you read a little bit from the book for us?
I will. Thank you. So this is a scene about when my parents first got together. The Negro cabbie asked Ella twice if she was sure of the address, if she wanted the colored side of town. She assured him she did, and when the cab pulled up to his place, Charles was waiting on the sidewalk. As he helped her out, the cabbie turned all the way around to glare at Charles. Man, why you want to mix me up in something like this? Just take the dollar, Charles said. You haven't seen a thing, understand? She went into his room at the boarding house and sat in the nicked easy chair as Charles fixed the Coke she asked for, adding a splash of whiskey before pouring a straight one for himself. She raised her glass and made a toast the boys at her acting group taught her. Here's to it and to it again. If you don't do it when you get to it, you'll never get to it to do it again. He liked the life in her eyes, the spirit in her soul. Without it, he realized, she would never have come over here. Charles turned on the radio to a moody blues tune. Then a colored announcer came on. Hey, all you cats out there. It's Saturday night. Get your best girl and cut a rug with us, where the party keeps it going all night long. He pulled her up to dance, though she protested that she wasn't much good. Ella Fitzgerald was on, and while they tried, neither could follow what the other was doing. She knew the foxtrot with its set patterns, and he knew the country mule. They laughed through false turns and stepping on each other's toes, but when a slow tune came on, they did better. Charles folded her into his chest, and she followed his simple steps. In no time, they were cooking dinner together at his place a couple of nights a week. But as they grew into love, Charles began to worry. He didn't think she understood the trouble she could get into for being with him. Did this white girl even know she could be attacked in the street for it? Did she have any idea of what she could face for breaking the unwritten Jim Crow codes? Some of the Indianapolis and Marion County elected officials were open members of the Klan. They posed as good guys, doing community service like giving away wheelchairs and food to white citizens. But did Ella understand that the Grand Wizard, a man named Stevenson, used to run the nationwide Ku Klux from Indianapolis? That they hated Negroes so much, they terrorized and killed them? She didn't. Two Negro men got lynched in Marion, Indiana, a few years before he and Ella took up. After a robbery and murder, a white woman claimed rape. The suspected men were locked up briefly until a white mob broke into the jail with sledgehammers and strung them up. Charles saw a picture postcard of the lynching taped up next to the price list at the black barbershop. On it, a big crowd of men and women milled around the brown bodies hanging from trees, their white faces satisfied. The victims' heads bent over their nooses where their necks had been broken, their limp legs dangling free. Their bodies were left on display as whites congratulated themselves on delivering vigilante justice. That was the proof, the man in the next barber's chair told Charles, of how the Klan was the law in Indianapolis. Don't take no chances in these parts, he said. Nobody has been called to account. As happened at many lynchings, studio photographers shot a ghastly picture, then sold thousands of copies, like circus souvenirs, to white people who wanted a keepsake. Charles sent Ella down to explain how it was. Somebody could get the law on him because of their relationship, trump up the charges, throw him in jail, beat him half to death, or lynch him for touching a white woman. And nobody would do a thing about it. He was getting pretty scared, and she should be too. Ella had to understand that for her part, the place where they both worked would fire her if they found out. It would be a scandal, and all white people would turn their backs on her. My brother David, who was listening with me to this story, wiped his brow with the handkerchief he always carried and asked incredulously, "You mean this was the first you heard of any of this, Mama? How could you not know?" "My life had only been in the white community up to then," Mama said. "I was completely sheltered from that kind of thing. Negro business wasn't my business, nor anyone's I knew. My family didn't follow politics or race, and even if they had, a lynching wasn't anything to talk to a young lady about. When your father explained all this to me, I had only the vaguest idea." Charles wanted Ella to think these risks through before they saw each other again. She had to decide if the risks were worth it. Could she live with her family never knowing about them, to staying alert all the time so they never made that one mistake that would ruin their lives? He took Ella by the shoulders and finally said he loved her. Loved her so much he was willing to face the dangers. Charles's forehead sweat and his voice dropped deep with desperation when he said he had to be sure she loved him the same way. He pulled her close and stroked her thick curls. "Take some time to think hard before you answer me," he said. "I mean it. And if you don't come back, I'll understand. Thank you."
And that was Dolores Johnson reading from Say I'm Dead.
Yeah, but I don't understand. I can't understand why people are like that. Why they hate that. I don't know. I just can't get my head around it, I guess.
Well, Carolyn, we have to think about the history of the United States to know the answer to that question, where Black people were brought here in the 1600s as slaves.
Yes.
And the slaves were considered inferior. In some cases, people didn't think they were even human. And then after the Civil War, where Black people were declared free, many people invented these, what they call Jim Crow codes, which were ways to keep Black people in their place and not give them full freedom. So the right to vote was denied. You know, they had all those different poll taxes, and that's what the freedom riders were about, trying to get the vote for the Black people. And the civil rights laws didn't change until 1964. All this time, Americans are thinking that Black people are not equal. And there was this political party in 1948 called the Dixiecrats. And these were the people who split off from the Democratic Party, and their platform was segregation. You remember George Wallace? See, these things are embedded in the psyche of America. They've been here for 400 years. This keeping Black people away, keeping them down. And the Dixiecrats declared that interracial marriage was an abomination against white purity. They said that people like me were mongrels. I was a child, a small baby, when this Dixiecrat party came into being.
I'm glad to have read this book, because it really opened my eyes to what people had to go through.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Caroline. I wanted to write this book for that reason. I felt that it was a slice of American life that needed more of a spotlight, because we don't talk about this, or we don't know these kinds of stories in most of America, especially what it took for people who wanted to intermarry. To what they had to go through and sacrifice. And I also wanted to write this story to show how things have changed in America. Because I mentioned earlier about that national poll that was taken in 1958, where 96% of Americans are against race mixing. And the Gallup poll, who conducted that survey, has been tracking these attitudes all along. And when the 2020 census was recently conducted, the Gallup poll and the Census Bureau issued a statement that the fastest growing demographic in the United States are mixed race people. That means that intermarriage between all races, so you can have, you know, a Mexican American with a white, or you can have a Japanese with a Black, or any combination. Those people crossing the racial line is the biggest growing group in the country. And maybe you've heard that the Census Bureau has issued a projection that in 2044, the United States will be a majority of minorities. white people will be less than 50% by that time. And so this whole trend, which started back with my parents, is moving forward. You know, they took up in 1943, and the census is saying in 2143, so 200 years, is that right? No, I'm not saying that right. 100 years later, it's completely reversed from 96% against it to, guess what? Today, 94% saying race mixing is okay. I do talks to high school students under a program called Facing History, and I always do a survey. So these are kids, you know, teenagers, and the polls that they have given me shows that almost 90% or over 90% say that race mixing is good for American society. So you see that. And also there was a study that showed Gen X. So that's people up to, I think, around 30, say that race mixing is good for American society.
Wow. Okay, now tell us why you chose this title.
Yes, the title comes from words that came out of my mother's mouth. So I had done a genealogy search on my father's side. We remember the movie Roots that came out, and everybody got the craze of searching their roots. And of course, now we have 23andMe and Ancestry.com and all this. Everybody wants to know what their background is. And so I did too. And so in my 30s, I started trying to put together the history of my father's family, which of course was the only family I knew. And I went down to Alabama and looked up this old Aunt Willie, who had a lot of facts that I never knew. In fact, she's the one who told me that my grandmother was the product of a plantation rape. My family had hidden that from me too. And when I typed up all these different generations of people, all these names I've heard over the years, but I didn't know how exactly I was related to them and so forth, I have this big, you know, legal sheet of paper with about maybe 60 people on it. And when I stand back and look at it, there's only one white person in my family tree. And all of a sudden, I knew that wasn't right.
Yeah.
Like, she had to be from somebody somewhere, but who? So I went home and I asked, you know, for all the family come. My mom fixed her favorite meal we all loved. And Saturday night, we're sitting around the kitchen table and they're talking, you know, I was in Buffalo and they're talking about the Buffalo Bills football game and all of that. And I say to them, you know, actually, I have something I want to talk about. And they say, what? And I say, half of our family is missing. And they all look at me like I'm from Mars. What are you talking about? And I turn to my mother and I say, Mama's family is missing. We don't know who they are and we've never heard about them. And my mom makes this sort of a squeaky sound and she sits up in her chair. And, you know, she was a proper lady. Her house dress kind of rises up. She jerks up in a chair and rises up over her knees, which we almost never saw her knees. You know? And she says, well, what are you talking about? So we had quite a long weekend where we talked about who and why we didn't know about my mom's family. It was a very emotional, very, very emotional time. And that is when they told the story that I read to you just a few minutes ago. So all of us kids are in our 30s, and it's the first time we know that they have run away from the law and been hiding for 36 years. And I say to them, listen, I really feel like, you know, my whole identity has tilted. Like, I don't really know who I am, and half of my story is missing, so I want to go. This is the first time I knew that she even came from Indiana. I want to go to Indiana and find your family. And my mom is crying and she's very upset. I mean, if you can imagine having kept a secret for 36 years and never having contacted your family ever in that whole time, how emotional she would feel. And she said, listen, if you want to do this for yourself, I can understand what you're saying, but you have to leave me out of it because I could never face them again, you know, after what I did, letting them think I'm dead all this time. And I said, but if I find them, what am I supposed to say about you? And she kind of hesitated and she was nervous. And she finally said, say I'm dead. And that's how I titled the book. Yeah, it was a very emotional weekend. But finally, they did begin to tell me enough details of, you know, where her address was and what the names in the family were and where she went to school and all these different clues that would help me try to locate them.
And you did go.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I went and I spent a week out there. And of course, you know, this was back before the internet and all of those.
I was going to say, I don't think your parents could have hidden that way today. You know, that the police would have found your mom because they went and got married. So there would have been a record, you know, that, but back then before the internet, you know, they wouldn't have known where to look. But now you do a Google search and it would come up.
That's a good point.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So mine was a paper and pencil and shoe leather search. And,
right.
I went out and walked the neighborhood, and their house was gone due to urban renewal. And I went to the church where she told me she always worshipped and where I figured they'd have records about her, and the rectory and the church were closed. I went to the vital records office where I found the death certificate for her dad. Now, when she told me her background, there was so much affection in her voice about her dad. She was his favorite. She loved him so much. And she told me, when you see dad, memorize his face. I want to know everything, how he looks and how he sounds and everything, you know. And about a day into the search, I found out he'd been dead for 30 years.
Hmm.
And
he really did look for her. I mean, he was really trying to find her too, wasn't he?
Yes, he went to New York when the FBI was searching for her. He'd never been to the big city like that, and he traveled her route that she took on the train, mm-hmm. trying to figure out, you know, where she might have been and what could have happened. And the day that the detective closed the case and said that she could have been sold into white slavery or murdered, he just stood outside that police building and howled. He was so devastated.
Yeah.
But in my search, I read every marriage license for 10 years in these big ledger books. This one clerk, you know, it was the same handwriting. And I'm looking for this aunt of mine, her only sister. No marriage license. I call everybody in the county that had any kind of a name that looked like Dorothy Lewis, which was her sister's name. Nobody. I talked to all kinds of people who were sorry they couldn't help, who were annoyed that I called, who, you know, wouldn't return my call, all these kinds of calls. And it was time for me to go home. I had to go back to work. And all I had was that death certificate and the word of the vital records lady who said, you know, your grandmother disappeared out of the directory in town in 47. And she had been really sick with what they called consumption in those days. So I wasn't surprised. She said, but they didn't keep enough records. And so the fact that we don't have a death record for her doesn't mean anything. It looks like she died before the grandfather. So I go to the airport and I'm very discouraged. I haven't found really what I was looking for, which was to meet the family. And I'm a person who's always ahead of time, so I arrived to the airport early and had extra time. And so in those days, it was phone booths, and I went in, put my dime in, and called the rectory of the church again, because that priest had never called me back. And he answers the phone. And he tells me, oh, I found your aunt's wedding record. She was married here at the church. She married a man, and he gave me the name, who was stationed in California during World War II. That was the address he gave. Now I'm thinking, I got to go to California. So I thanked the priest, and when I hung up, you know, they used to have printed directories, telephone directories, hanging on chains in those phone booths.
That's so right. I remember that.
So I pull this big, heavy directory up on the counter, and I look in there, and I find the man's name. So I call that number, and a lady answers the phone. And I say to her, you don't know me, but I think we might be related. I want to ask you some questions, see if you're the person I'm looking for. And she said, okay. She told me later she thought I was trying to sell her something. So I say, well, your father's name was Henry Lewis? Yes. And you lived at 625 Woodlawn Avenue? Yes. And you went to St. Patrick's Church? Yes. All these different questions. And then I say, you had a sister who disappeared in the early 40s. And she sucks in her breath. And she says, yes. I say, her name was Myrna Elizabeth. She said, no. Now I don't know what to do. There's a line accumulating of people wanting to use the phone. Right? And so I start over and just ask the same questions. And she's saying, yes, 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 yes. And you can hear the urgency in her voice now. She's really trying to figure this out, too. And I say, your sister's nickname was Ella. She said, Ella, yes, that's my sister, Ella. You know how there's somebody in the family that everybody calls Junior? Mm-hmm. And you don't know what his given name is? And that was the story. She didn't know my mother's given name.
Wow.
So I say to her, I'm in the airport in Indianapolis. I've been looking for you all week, and I wanted to meet you. But now it's time for me to go home. Wait. And do you know what happened? I look across at my gate, and there's somebody changing the departure time by 2 hours delay.
Yep, that's...
I mean, can you believe it? Can you believe it? And so she says to me, stay right there, I'm coming. She didn't say, what do you look like, or what gate, what airline, nothing. She hung up. So I'm standing there now, and I've got my briefcase, and I've got on a suit, and I'm watching all these people. This is before TSA and all the terrorism. So there's, you know, people running down the corridor trying to catch their plane, and babies falling down, screaming in the floor, and they're part of the cleaning people, and all these announcements on the PA. It's just a chaos, and I'm just standing there. And after a while, I see this older woman. She's almost like staggering. She's got her eyes fixed on me, and she's coming up the concourse, and she walks straight up to me, and she says, it's you, isn't it? I see my sister in your face.
Wow.
I have such chills in my spine, I can't speak. We go in the coffee shop, and her husband comes with us, and he's not saying much. He's like, I guess he's the bodyguard, you know, he's looking and seeing, trying to see what this is all about. But we sit there, we order coffee, and, you know, I wanted to meet them so bad, but I never thought about what I would say to them. And they're shocked. So we're all there stirring this coffee and not saying a word. And finally, my aunt looks up and she says to me, why would my sister have run off from her loving family without a word in all of these years? We thought she was dead. And I said, I know you thought she was dead, but she married a black man. And then I tell her the story. And how she didn't want to harm the family. And she's just shaking her head. And I explained to her about this law they had in Indiana where it was illegal to get married. And her husband says, well, that was a damn fool of law.
Well, that's for sure.
And then my aunt says, 35 years we could have been together. Oh my gosh, where's my sister now? So my mother told me what I had to say. And so I said, I hated it. I said she was dead. Now, I haven't thought about this at all either. So now they ask me, well, how did she die? When did she die? Where is she buried? You know, I'm just making up one lie after the other. I'm thinking, okay, you traveled out here and made all this effort to meet these people, and the first thing you do is sit here and tell a pile of lies.
Oh, golly.
How is that going to work out, you know? But anyway, we exchanged information. I found out that she had kids the same years my mom had us. They both were nurses' aides. There were so many similarities. They hadn't heard from each other in all this time, and yet they had lived the same life. Her husband worked in a plant at GM. My father was a welder. I mean, there was just parallel after parallel. And I called my mom, and she went all to pieces. You know, she wanted to know everything. How did they look? And I had shown them a picture of our family, and she said to me, yes, that's my sister. That's my sister. And she showed her husband. She said, that is Ella. That is. And I had seen, you know, her girls. She had four daughters. And my mom wanted to know everything, but she still didn't want to get involved. But I know that time is of the essence in our interview here, but so I'll just.
Yeah, we are out of time.
We
will tell you. I will tell you that I did get my mom and her sister back together. And they, in turn, introduced all the extended family members, and we became one integrated family for the next 26 years. All the birthday parties and weddings and 4th of Julys shared together like any family would.
That makes me feel so happy. And we are out of time, but there's also, I want to mention that you write a lot about the book about things that you suffered, discrimination and bigotry and violence even. And the way that you wrote about it was so, I don't know, so matter of fact in a way that it was, that I found it extremely touching. And I think something that maybe even people who aren't open to thinking about this might really be touched and learn from. So I want to thank you for sharing those memories with the world.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Monica. And yes, I did face violent discrimination. I hope people will pick up a copy of Say I'm Dead and read about it, because one thing I think that allowed me to write about it calmly, even though we were frightened and we were at risk for a period of time, is that as a Black person, you kind of grow a shell, because there are so many ways that you can be slighted, abused, left out, not given access, mistreated, discouraged, ignored, hurt physically, mentally, that you become alert to the fact that there is danger around you all the time, and that you must take care of yourself, because even in this incident that you referred to, where a cross was burned on our lawn, the police did not help us. There's studies that show how Black people have much higher blood pressure and instances of depression than white people, because they live in constant concern about these issues. And so that's an important part of the book. Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, thank you. And Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. It's actually the last sentence in her book. Meanwhile, when my family's together, color is not our focus. Me and mine, and the millions of others who choose mixed race families, are going to keep on loving.
Thanks. Thank you, Dolores. And it's been a joy talking to you, and we never even really got to talk about how you wrote the book. So
right. Well, maybe that's another time.
Maybe that's another time.
Yeah, that's another one, right, exactly.
See you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.